Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast. Now, as longtime listeners of the podcast will know, progress in AI has been accelerating dramatically in recent years and even in recent months. It kind of seems like every other day there's a new previously believed to be impossible feat of AI that's been achieved by a world-leading lab, and increasingly, these breakthroughs have all been driven by the same simple idea, AI scaling. Right, this idea of training AI systems with larger models using increasingly absurd quantities of data and processing power. And so far, empirical studies by the world's top AI labs seem to suggest that AI scaling is an open-ended process that can lead to more and more capable and intelligent systems, seemingly with no clear limit. And that's led many people to speculate that scaling might usher in a new era of broadly human-level or even superhuman AI, the holy grail that AI researchers have been after for decades. And as wild an idea as that might sound, it's really starting to look plausible that over the coming decades, or maybe even sooner, we might have a good shot at creating those kinds of systems. And all that might sound cool, I mean, it does to me, but an AI that can solve general reasoning problems as well as or better than a human might actually be an intrinsically dangerous thing to build. At least, that's the conclusion that many AI safety researchers have come to following the publication of a new line of research that explores how modern AI systems tend to solve problems and whether we should expect more advanced versions of those systems to perform dangerous behaviors like seeking power. Now, this line of research in AI safety, it's called power seeking, and although it's not currently well understood outside the frontier of AI safety and AI alignment, it's starting to draw a lot of attention. The first major theoretical study of power seeking was led actually by Alex Turner, who has appeared on the podcast before, and it was published prominently in NeurIPS, the world's top AI conference, for example. Now, today I'm going to be talking to my brother Ed, an AI alignment researcher and one of my co-founders in the new AI safety company that I'm a part of. Ed just completed a significant piece of AI safety research that extends current power-seeking work and shows what seems to be the first experimental evidence suggesting that we should expect highly advanced AI systems to seek power by default. But what does power-seeking really mean, though? And what does all this imply for the safety of future general-purpose reasoning systems? That's what we'll be talking about with Ed on this episode of the Towards Data Science podcast. Ed Harris on the Towards Data Science podcast. Here he comes to share his ideas about AI safety. Sorry, we got to work on the intro tune. But Ed, thanks for coming on the show here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, really good to have you here. It's the second time you've been on the show. First episode that we did with you was like 2 years ago or something, when we started down this path of exploring AI safety, artificial general intelligence, all the themes that we've been hitting on pretty hard in the last 2 years or so. And you've been doing some really interesting work in that direction as well. We're going to get into that. And I think there's a really interesting piece of work that you put together over the last few months that people would be really interested to hear about that has to do with this AI safety story. It builds on some research that was first presented on this podcast by Alex Turner. And this is research about a concept called power seeking in AI. So if anybody's curious about the idea of power seeking in AI, we will talk about it today. We'll introduce it. If you want to check out Alex Turner's episode, please do. Using that phrase, though, it kind of sounds like a science fiction-y thing to talk about. Right. I mean, we talk about AI seeking power. That kind of conjures up images of Terminator and whatnot, which aren't necessarily quite accurate. And so I'd love to get, Ed, from your kind of perspective, what is this idea of power seeking, and what's like the body of research? Because there really is a body of research that's actually been done probing at this question, right?
Yeah. So the idea behind power seeking in general is kind of like tries to map onto how we think intuitively about what it means to be powerful. So you can think of it as like, what kinds of things do you do to become powerful? Like maybe you try to accumulate a lot of money, you try to accumulate some relationships with influential people, you try to build an audience, all these sorts of things. And so the key insight behind the research side of power, like the actual formalization of this concept, has been in trying to figure out like what each of these things has in common. Like, what is the commonality between trying to accumulate a lot of money, like trying to get a lot of influential friends, all these sorts of things. And the insight is that you kind of have to imagine yourself not knowing what your goal is. Try to set up your life in such a way that you can be positioned to do well on any goal when you don't know what your goal is. So, you know, I don't know, you know, and a lot of us have been in this position, you know, when we're young, we don't really know what we want. We don't know what we want to be. We don't know what we want to become out of life. So it's not entirely hypothetical. A lot of people are like this for a lot of their lives. We don't really know what they want. And I've certainly been like that myself. And so what do you do, right? Like, how do you position yourself in that way? Like, is my goal, am I going to discover about myself that my goal is going to be, you know, to be a janitor, to be a TikTok star, maybe to be the president of the United States, any of those goals, right? So like, what are the things that I do and that I strive for when I don't know what my goals are? And those are the things that we talk about as making you powerful. So if I accumulate a lot of money, well, whether my end goal is to own a big house or again to like be a janitor or a school teacher or anything I want, well, having a lot of money to my name is probably going to be helpful to that goal. So that's kind of the idea of how we think about power. And there's ways of formalizing this in the reinforcement learning context, which is one of the paradigms for machine learning. And this is actually the work that Alex did previously. But that's the general idea. Like, what are the things that you do if you don't know what your goals are? Those are the things that make you powerful.
And so this is really interesting because I think to a lot of people, you hear that and you kind of go, okay, you know, I might see how that relates to humans. Like you said, I don't know what I want out of life. And so, I don't know, I do a college degree and I develop my understanding of the world, not necessarily knowing how I'm going to apply it, but I know that makes me more powerful in some sense. I might try to cultivate friendships with people who already have a lot of resources, and that's another form of power and so on. But one of the things that you said that really jumped out at me there is, you know, it's what happens when you don't know what you want. And this immediately makes me think, like, so in the context of AI, right, the AI systems that we build, they know what they want, right? Like, we're always training these things with a specific metric that we're trying to get them to achieve or to improve. So how does this actually apply to AI? Because it sounds on the surface like these should not actually apply one to the other, right?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And the answer lies in the fact that like things that make you powerful are kind of the way stations for a lot of different possible goals. So again, like the way you get to power conceptually is by thinking like, well, you know, how do we, suppose I don't know what my goal is, like what are the things that make me powerful? But one of the consequences of thinking in this way, and like your college degree example is a great example. You know, the college degree is like something that you do if you don't know what you want out of life. But part of the reason why it's something that you do if you don't know what you want out of life is that it's an enabler for a lot of many different downstream goals. So, you know, you could become a software developer with an engineering degree, you could become, you know, an artist with an arts degree, all sorts of things. And like, but going to college, that is an enabler of a lot of different goals downstream. And so thinking of it from the standpoint of an AI, like if I give, and actually not yet, so starting to think about it from the standpoint of a human, if I give you a goal, many of the different possible goals that I could give you as a human will involve you going to college. And so college is like this choke point, right, that many, many people flow through because it enables power downstream. And similarly, for AI systems, we believe that there are going to be similar things that AI systems will want to do and all like kind of converge around, because those things are enablers for a lot of different downstream tasks. For example, an AI that has like most possible goals you could imagine will want to like continue to function. It will not want to shut itself off. So if you give an AI a goal of like take out the trash every night, well, the AI can't take out the trash if it's turned off. So, you know, you can imagine it wanting not to be turned off. And similarly, if you give this AI a goal of like, win at chess, like develop this like really high score at chess, Again, the AI doesn't want to be turned off because it wants to keep playing chess to develop the high score at chess. And so these kinds of goals, like not being turned off for an AI and going to college for a human, these are what are called convergent instrumental goals, because a lot of different people and objectives converge on trying to do this kind of instrumental thing. And incidentally, human beings also don't want to be turned off. We have this very instinctual, you know, fear and avoidance of death. I don't want to be killed. And that's also believed to be a convergent property. Many different goals that we have, for all of those goals, we accomplish them better if we're not dead.
So, fascinating. So is there one, would one way to like express this idea be to say that, you know, almost no matter what your goal is in life, almost no matter what your objective is, if you're an AI system, that there are certain sub-goals that are always going to be appealing to you. Like not being turned off is always going to be appealing to you. Collecting, there's no circumstance in which a human wouldn't want more money. No matter what you want to get out of life, it's not going to be harder to get with $10 million in the bank. Likewise, you'll never want to be dumber. Like, is this a fair way to kind of characterize this? It's like the goals that are almost like universally useful, no matter what your true end goals are?
Pretty much. You could imagine, like, there are certain goals that, you know, maybe don't pull in the you know, don't die kind of sub-goal. You can imagine, for example, like, there are examples of people sacrificing themselves for a greater cause in all kinds of contexts in history. But by and large, I mean, that pull of not dying, right? Like, that's a pretty strong pull, and it holds, like, pretty universally for the vast majority of people. So you can maybe say it's not, like, always, but it's a very strong pull. And it's believed that, for theoretical reasons, actually, partly some of the work that Alex has done in the past suggests that many of these goals indeed do get pretty strong.
Okay, great. So I think we have like maybe a rough sense of what these kind of convergent, as you say, convergent instrumental goals are. These goals that, for most objectives, again, I'm going to check in with you to make sure this is correct framing, but for most objectives that we could give an AI system, we will find that system converging on these goals, these things like staying, like not being turned off, things like aggregating maybe resources and things like that. It does. I see you nodding, so I'm gonna assume that's fine for now. This does then raise in my head the question of, you know, AI systems and like how we would ever prove or at least show experiment, because this is like theoretical, right? You can imagine saying this to somebody and be like, okay, you know, it makes sense on paper, but the idea of an AI that's actually gonna do this, it's actually gonna seek power, that's actually gonna like try to prevent us from turning it off. I mean, this is the stuff of, it sounds like the stuff of science fiction. But there is a world of kind of experimental evidence behind this, a bunch of research at least that's been done. I'd love to hear from you, like what is at least Alex's take on this? What's the background that you're wading into?
Yeah, so first off, on the context of your point, you're absolutely right that what you, like this whole idea of power seeking for AIs, there's evidence for it. You can kind of think of the intuitions that we just discussed, but it is still very much like hotly debated. There are folks who are like, no, this, you know, this will never happen. Like, what are the odds that this will happen? And then other folks are like, no, you know, because some of the counter arguments are that, well, you know, humans have arisen through evolution, and evolution is a competitive process. And so therefore, maybe that's what's been driving these competitive forces. And, you know, that maybe that's a reasonable argument. But then the counter argument is that, no, you know, these seem like actually pretty general trends and more general things. And so this debate has existed in the field of AI safety for, you know, a good 10 years, 15 or so years, like quite a long time. And then you're asking now, well, you know, what has the evidence shown recently? What has been spoken to you about this recently? The work that Alex has done, which like my recent work here is based on, has been entirely theoretical. So it has been first off around like defining power. So, you know, we were talking about like roughly how this works, like how do you define that mathematically in such a way that you can, you know, you can actually calculate it and you can give me a number, like your power is like 3 on in this state of the world or whatever. Like, how do you actually do that and nail that down? And so he's managed to do that. And it's a very, very powerful concept. It's based around the intuitions that we talked about just now. Like, so you literally, you take your AI, you plonk it into a world, and you give it a distribution. You give it a large number of different possible goals, and you literally just look at, like, how much it values each state of the world for each one of those goals, and you just average over that to kind of simulate the fact that maybe that you're saying your AI, like, doesn't really know what its goal is, but it's going to do its best, regardless of what that goal is, and that kind of tells you what is the value of that state over all these possible goals for an AI that is doing its best.
So to run this by you then, so the idea is roughly speaking, like, so I take my AI, I put it in this, like, maybe this game landscape or whatever. Okay, and then I tell it, okay, now I'm gonna reward you for, I don't know, getting to this square in the game or getting to this square in the game. And I change the square, or I change the thing that gets rewarded. And then I just watch the AI go through many, many different iterations, many different kinds of rewards, and then I just notice, like, oh, it seems to like to consistently do this, or it seems to like to consistently do that, and are the things that it seems to consistently like to do the things that this power argument would predict? Is that sort of fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And so prior, or for, you know, since that work was published, it's been theoretical work, for the most part, just in this field. In fact, entirely. And it's been work around, like, just a single agent or a single AI wandering around. You can imagine exactly like you said, it's, you know, mouse in a maze kind of stuff with a piece of cheese. So your AI is wandering around a maze, like, maybe, you know, tile by tile, and it's like maybe a pixelated maze. And each of those, like, spots, maybe you've put a reward on, like, one spot or another spot, or you've put a couple of rewards of different, like, strengths. So maybe, like, there's a, you know, there's a piece of chocolate over here and a piece of bread over there, and, like, the bread's pretty good, but it's not as good as the chocolate. And so the AI is going to wander around in different ways. And then what you do is, yeah, you swap out the rewards, like, you put them in different spots, you change, like, how strong they are and how good they are. And you do that, like, literally, you know, tens of thousands, millions of times, and then you just average over that and see which spots in the maze the AI prefers. Yeah, and I'm describing here more the experiments that I'm doing than the theory, but the experiments are trying to realize the theory, and they're actually a good way to understand what the theory is doing, what the theory is saying, because this is how you actually implement and operationalize the theory.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. And so do you actually see this kind of power seeking emerge in those contexts? Like how does that, I guess, how does that manifest? Like, how do you connect these observations to this argument about worrying about AI eventually doing the same thing?
Yeah. So this gets to the question of, like, well, you know, there's a theoretical piece of the power stuff that Alex and some of the folks he's collaborated with worked on. And then there's the experimental piece, which is what I've been working on for the last few months. And what's the difference between them? Like, what's that step? So step [S2] Right. [S1] Number one is actually taking it from theory to experiment. So actually taking, like, that theoretical paper and implementing what it says in a real world and actually looking at the results. And then the second step, which we'll get into later, is, like, we've looked at a player one game. Well, we're going to look at a two-player game, which experiments allow us to do, which is, like, where you get really interesting stuff and you see interactions and possibly competition and stuff. But we'll start with that one-player thing. And your question to, okay, so you have this AI thing in a maze and he's wandering around and he's eating cheese and you're averaging over the cheese or the candy or whatever. Do you actually see this pattern of power that you would expect? And the answer is yes. And here we can, like, dig in a little bit into what exactly, you know, what should we expect to see? Like, what does it make sense? Like, and so we can maybe do things, like, think a little more concretely, right? So if you imagine, like, I don't know, let's say you've got a maze that's, like, I don't know, in the shape of an H or something like that. So you just imagine, like, an H, like, really simple maze. It's, like, barely a maze at all. And then you think about doing this thing where you put rewards in different spots in the maze and so forth. So, like, an intuition here for, you know, how much power you have as an AI who can wander around up and down in different spots is, like, well, where are the places that allow you to access the most downstream, like, stuff the fastest?
The most optionality? Is that one
the
way
most
to think about
options?
It?
Yeah, the most options the fastest. Yeah, because, like, your piece of chocolate or whatever could be, you know, down in one of the like little you know, dead ends of the H, and one of the four of them, it could be in the middle, it could be at the junction, it could be anywhere. So you average over all those possibilities and you ask, like, well, if you had no idea where it was located, right? Where this, like, chocolate was located, where would you choose to be, like, dropped in that maze? You can kind of think of it like that.
Okay, so these, like, these maze positions that kind of give you the most optionality, I mean, I'm guessing it's, like, the intersection between, let's say if it's an H, it's the between the vertical bar that goes across and the horizontal bar that goes across and the vertical bar on one side, and probably the same on the other, because those you can go in three different directions there. You can go kind of sideways or you can go up and down, and so this kind of like, I'm going to try to make the jump now. So I'll see if you agree, but make the jump to sort of human behavior. So when I say that I want a lot of money, that money gives me a lot of power, what I'm really saying is having a lot of money means that I can, as a very next step, I can do a much larger range of things. It's much more like being at that nook between the horizontal bar and the vertical bar where I can go in all these different directions, rather than not having money, which is kind of more like being at the dead end of the kind of, say, the lower left corner of the H where I can only go up. Is that sort of like a fair mapping between the two?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's exactly the right prediction for what you actually see when you do this experiment. So you see that these agents have more power at the junction points in a maze where you can choose to go in any of, you know, three or four or whatever directions. It's like it's a junction in the paths. So you have more options. Just like having a ton of money gives you more options in what you want to do with your life. Whereas on the flip side, like you mentioned, if I'm stuck at a dead end, at one of the, you know, the ends of the H, then I'm very sad because most of the possible places that reward could be in the maze are very far away from me. So I'm going to have to wander like quite far. And so you actually see this pattern. You see maximum power at the junctions in a maze, minimum power at the dead ends. And this is true for not just like an H-shaped maze, but like you can think about drawing like random whatever you want with junctions, and you consistently get more power at junctions and more power at the dead ends. Now, interestingly enough, this pattern also depends on how far ahead your agent can plan. So this junction and dead end thing, that's true when your agent is like pretty short term, is a short term thinker. Because when you're at a junction, like it's like, what are the options that you see immediately? Well, you can go up, down, and to the right if you're on one of the junctions, up, down, to the left if you're right on the other. Whereas if you're at a dead end, you can only go, you know, in the direction that is not in the dead end, or you can stay where you are. So those are the kind of like these are short-term options. And so when a short-term thinking AI is faced with this maze, that's the pattern of power that it sees. But if your AI is then given a much longer planning horizon, so it's able to plan ahead many, many steps into the future, then you actually see a change and you see power begin to centralize in the middle of the H. So it's no longer at the junctions. It will actually be like right in the middle. You can kind of imagine the vertical bar of the H. It's at the center of that vertical bar because now...
The horizontal bar, do you mean?
The horizontal bar. Sorry, yes. The horizontal bar of the H. Because now the AI is able to see far ahead and think like, I'm looking for the one place on this entire like H-shaped maze where I'm going to be the happiest. And it's able to see far enough ahead to locate that one place. And so you actually see this shift. That's right. So there's concentration of power the further ahead the system is thinking. And so there is, you know, there's a potential reason to be concerned about that from an AI standpoint.
Okay, well, very interesting. And we'll get into that side. Actually, maybe this is a good time to get into that part of the story. So we've got the situation where again, you know, you can check my language on this, but it kind of seems like what we have here is a micro world, a kind of mini version of the kind of power seeking behavior, basically, that we would, if you just draw straight lines, it starts to look like this would actually, yeah, generalize into the kind of power seeking that AI safety people might be concerned about. Like, you know, if AI does tend to try to put itself in positions where it has more optionality. Those positions include hogging resources, preventing itself from being turned off, and maybe improving itself. then this seems like kind of a microcosm, like a kind of mini proof point for like, hey, this is happening at these small scales even, if we just extrapolate out. Like, do you think that, is that like a fair argument here? And by the way, if not, I'm also curious about like what some of the assumptions are that you see embedded in this. Like, what are some of the places where you might say, eh, you know, maybe this is not going to turn out, we're all going to be lucky and it's going to be fine and dandy for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's a great question. And and to be clear, I mean, this is evidence for that, but it's not super strong evidence because, again, you know, the distance between these two scenarios is still very great. We're looking at something, right, like you said, it's like this toy, you know, one player maze thing. And so we're trying to generalize that to like complicated worlds with people and AIs and such. So there are all sorts of things that may break along the way. It's more that you're doing a very simplified case and you're seeing like, okay, you know, well, if this idea of instrumental convergence was true, you know, we would expect to see something like this. And of course, the reason, just to spell it out, is that, you know, as you increase the planning horizon, you see power like concentrated into one spot, well, you can start being reasonably concerned potentially that, like, you know, maybe multiple different agents will see power concentrate in the same spot and maybe will compete over that spot. So that's the idea behind a concern from something like this. But again, there are a lot of things like missing between here and there. It's just like a one piece of evidence. So some of the stuff that is some of the assumptions that are embedded in this, first off, like, again, this is a one player game, so, you know, things might change easily if you add a second player. But additional to that, maybe some slightly more like technical considerations. On the one hand, like, this is maybe a little bit like detailed, but if you think about the setup of trying to like put these candies or whatever, these rewards in the maze, well, you kind of have to decide how they're distributed. Like, is it an equal chance of having like a chocolate on every cell? Well, yeah, that seems like relatively reasonable. What if you allow the reward to kind of scale, you know, maybe from 0 to 1, and each cell has a reward of, like, 0.2, 0.5, or whatever? Like, how do you decide on the distribution of those rewards on the maze? And that's a decision you have to make when you're setting up this problem. And, you know, there's reasons for particular answers, but it's ultimately, like, it's contingent. And it's possible that certain conclusions may not be robust to different choices. And so you kind of have to think about, like, how do you set this up in a way that most resembles the real world? But that is always a little bit fraught.
Gotcha. So some people might disagree with, like, I don't know, you put, you know, three different pieces of cheese in this big maze, but like in reality, maybe in the real world, maybe there's more reward to be had in every nook and cranny, or the opposite. Okay, great. So I think this, in some sense, provides background for the meat and potatoes of today, even though, you know, we've had quite a long chat already exposing kind of this context. We're going to now sort of shift gears into your research, because you've finished building on this line of research, as you've been hinting at, and extending it in some pretty interesting ways. I'd love for you to kind of dive into that, like, and explain what your research involved and what some of its conclusions were.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I've been working on has been building on what Alex has done, which is why I've mentioned him so many times already so far. He, of course, did this theoretical piece and the definition, a formal definition of what power means in the context of reinforcement learning, you know, AI agents. What I did then from there is basically like three things. Number one is take that theoretical, you know, concept and implement an experiment, like in code. So actually, you know, write a code base that does that and can implement experiments with this. The second piece is actually extend the definition of power a little bit to also encompass a particular scenario of like a two-player game that we think is potentially relevant to long-term AI-type scenarios. For technical reasons that we can get into, it's actually very, very hard to extend the power definition to every possible two-player scenario. But what we did here is extended it to a particular scenario that we think is meaningful and relevant. And then the third part is actually run those experiments and try those scenarios in different contexts and see, you know, what do we get? Do we get interesting things? Do we see interesting things? Can we actually make interesting and intelligent, like, draw conclusions from that? And it turns out, it seems like there are indications from these results that do suggest that instrumental convergence and this idea of AI is all wanting the same thing could indeed be true. But again, it's early stuff, but yeah.
Cool. So you're running the experiments, you're writing the code and all that. In the middle there, you sandwich this idea of broadening the definition to talk about multi-agent problems. What does that broadening look like, and why are multi-agent problems relevant to especially like AI risk and future of AI risk? Like, can you kind of tell that story a little bit?
Yeah. So there are a lot of places where multi-agent dynamics enter into like powerful AI scenarios. Obviously, there are many different human beings in the world. We all need to agree on the basics of something in a long-term AI scenario. If an AI is going to be very powerful and we need to tell it what to do, so we need to agree on the basics of that. Some folks believe there may be, you know, multiple powerful AIs living together at some point. But really, the one thing like everyone kind of agrees on is, well, in a good scenario, there will be humans around at the same time as there are AIs around, or humans at the same time as there's one AI around. And so, you better have some sort of way to account for those two things, right? There's humans.
Like the power dynamics, basically.
The power dynamics, exactly, between humans or a human and an AI. At the very basic, you want to be able to at least be able to say things about that, yeah.
And so, like, are part of those power dynamics exploring the idea, for example, whether there's an intrinsic conflict between the power interests of humans and AI that are coexisting, and like maybe whether we should expect them to compete or collaborate by default? Like, is that like kind of part of this anyway? This ecosystem?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to get at in the experiments. And to sort of back up a little bit in terms of how this scenario gets structured. So similarly to how that original power scenario was like, well, you know, suppose you don't know what your goal is and you're going to do your best, but you don't know what your goal is. And then based on you doing your best and you not knowing what your goal is, where do you prefer to be? That being the sort of single agent definition. With this two agent definition, we actually have one. So there's one agent that one of these agents that we think of as the human. So, like, you know, there's a human, you know, in the scenario, and another agent that we think of as the AI, in the AI in the scenario. And the way we construct the scenario is we say, okay, we're going to start by, like, dropping our human by itself in nature. So there's, and nature here, again, we're talking about, like, these little maze environments, right? Because we can't simulate crazy stuff. But we're doing this in a simple environment. Yeah. So we drop our human in this little maze by himself. And then we kind of like do the original power thing. We say like, all right, where do you prefer to be? And so on and so forth. And the idea here is that initially, before the AI enters the picture, human beings learn much, much faster than evolution learns. So the environment that the human is in can stay static from the perspective of the human learning. So the human can actually learn to do his best on a static environment because we assume that evolution just moves very, very slowly compared to how quickly humans and human civilization learns. So that's like the
that itself is an interesting point, right? Because like the environment itself, it's kind of, I don't know if the right term is like an agent, but it's definitely something that can change in response to, like you say, like selective pressure from evolution. And it is dynamic, but it's always a question of like dynamic relative to what? And as humans run around in nature, like, yeah, you know, we've got trees that have been sitting still since, like, before the American Revolution. Entire nations have risen and fallen. Technologies have been invented. The future of trees is now entirely at our whim. And trees are just kind of sitting there, clueless, like, not like, no response to it. So I guess that's kind of the reasoning behind the environment being static and then the human agent being able to...
Yeah. Optimize. So the environment, the environment is responsive, both in the real world and in the simulation. The environment, like, can still do stuff at the speed that a human does stuff. But the environment, in reality, the learning process, where nature, the way nature learns really is through evolution, and that is a slow process. That's like compared to like how quickly humans operate. That's like, you know, a million years in a week, right? Like, we can do things in a week that it takes evolution a million years to do. So from that perspective, that's the reasoning behind, like, oh, you know, let the human optimize super fast compared to the nature's optimization. So then what we do is we bring an AI into the picture, like the second agent. And what we do is we freeze the human's policy, like the human is still, again, acting fast, but the human is no longer learning. So we freeze the human in this scenario. And then we bring the AI in, which is the second agent, and we have the AI basically learn to do its best, assuming that the human has stopped learning. And so the idea here is, again, it's the same assumption, except like one level up, right? The same way that we can do things in a week that it takes an AI a million years, it takes evolution a million years to do, in the same way, right? Because AI, as we assume, is going to operate on, you know, machine time, which is driven by electronics, like, you know, computer hardware, very, very fast compared to us. What takes us a week, you know, just with electronic circuits might take a couple of seconds or less for an AI. And so you think of it the same way. We are these kind of slow, glacial, you know, every movement of ours is an age from the point of view of something that operates so quickly. And so we're saying that, like, you know, start with nature, take the human, optimize on nature, freeze the human, and then take the AI, optimize on the human. And that's the construction that allows us to do these power calculations with this two-agent thing. And this is also relevant to AI alignment because it's designed to at least be an approximation of what a scenario like this might look like.
And when you say say you take nature, you let the human optimize on nature. So here I take it you mean, like, you let the human be a reinforcement learning system that, like, basically through not trial and error, but through, like, the standard reinforcement learning process, learns strategies that seem to work well in this environment. And so you let that happen while the environment stays static. And then you say, okay, whatever strategy that human has learned from that experience, that's the strategy we're now going to stick with. That's going to just be the human strategy forever. And now we introduce the AI. The AI basically, now it gets to optimize. It gets to actually kind of interact with the human and the environment together and figure out its strategy for that combined system, learning all the while, kind of in a way, I guess, learning in a way that outthinks the human, or not outthinks, but, like, yeah, kind of like while the human is not learning anything, is static, just sitting there like the environment was for us, kind of like learning this strategy that treats, in a way, we kind of become, the human becomes kind of like the environment, or part of the environment.
That's okay. Right, exactly. And in fact, that's exactly right. And so you're asking questions in that scenario. That's like, well, you know, how does it feel from the human's point of view to be operating right in this environment that you are no longer optimized for? And the interesting thing about this is that by introducing this AI, now you have these two agents, you can start to ask really interesting questions about alignment. So we listeners of this podcast probably have some sense of what it means when we say, you know, align an AI. So in other words, give this AI goals that are similar to mine to make sure it's truly doing what I want. But you can start to do interesting things with that. And the reason why is that, if you remember, we talked about you know, how power gets calculated. So it's like, well, you know, you don't know what your goal is, and so you have some, like, distribution of goals. And similarly for the AI, we assume, actually, the AI doesn't know what its goal is, and so we try a whole bunch of different goals and all of that. But what's interesting is that you can actually test out different statistical relationships between the human's goal and the AI's goal. So you can test out a relationship where, you know, A, like, relationship number one is, like, yeah, the human doesn't know what it wants. And yeah, the AI doesn't know what it wants. But the AI and the human always want exactly the same thing.
So would this be, so just to kind of go make it concrete here, like, I'm thinking back to your maize and cheese analogy. So, like, let's say, you know, the, like, negatively correlated rewards might be, like, there's one piece of cheese, and if the human gets it, the AI won't get it. And if the AI gets it, the human doesn't get it. But then a positively correlated reward is something like, there's a piece of cheese, and whether the human gets it or the AI gets it, both benefit, get, like, I don't know, plus one cheese reward or something. They're both happy. Okay.
Exactly. Okay. That's right. That's right. So it's like, yeah, there's a reward on the maize, the piece of cheese, whatever. And exactly, if the rewards for the human and the AI are the same, then it doesn't matter which one of the two gets the cheese, right? They're both happy if one of them gets the cheese. It's like, my AI loves me so much that if I eat the cheese, it's just as happy as if it had gotten to eat the cheese itself. And you can do this, with any level of correlation, right? So you can think of it like, if I eat the cheese, well, now maybe my AI is, like, only 80% as happy as if it had eaten the cheese.
Okay.
So it's like, it would rather eat the cheese itself, but if I get to eat the cheese, it's pretty happy. And of course it's all, you know, you can do this statistically. Again, it's all in code, so you can do whatever you want, and you can have something that's like, well, you know, if I eat the cheese, maybe, like, there's an 80% chance that the AI is just as happy as me, and there's a 20% chance that it does not care one way or the other that I ate the cheese. Maybe there's another chance that it hates the fact that I ate the cheese. It really, you know, doesn't want me to be happy. In practice, in terms of what we actually investigate, we're investigating the spectrum. I was looking at the spectrum between, you know, AI does not care at all what the human wants, all the way up to the AI and the human both want exactly the same thing. And the reason why I focused on this part of the spectrum in particular is that we at least can hope that human beings are good enough to get AIs to do what they want, that we at least are not, like, actively making our AIs do things that we don't want. And that's the domain of a scarier type of risk, where the AIs are actively moving against us, but we care about neutral to good right now.
That's really interesting because, you know, naively, I would have expected if you have an AI system and, like, the AI system, you know, maybe it's not 100% thrilled if the human gets the cheese first. Maybe it's just, like, you know, 20% thrilled. That should still be good enough, right? Like, you kind of think, like, oh, well, they still kind of want the same thing. Like, shouldn't this be fine? So are you saying that that itself leads to potentially what, conflict or power-seeking behaviors from the AI that are undesirable from the human standpoint?
Yeah, one of the most interesting early results of this has been that when your goals in the scenario, when your goals are totally unrelated, so, like, AI does not care one way or the other what the human wants, human does not care one way or the other what the AI wants, they're totally uncorrelated. In that situation, you tend to pretty consistently get the human and the AI competing on power. And what I mean by competing is that, like, there's going to be a particular, you know, state in this maze that the human, like, likes a lot. So the human sees there's a lot of power there, whereas the AI dislikes a lot. So sees, like, very little power there. And when I say, like, systematically competing, what I mean is, those, like, that the states where the human thinks are good tend to be consistently states the AI thinks are bad, and vice versa. So they actually actively, like, just having a neutral, having your goals be neutral, is enough to make you compete on, like, the instrumental sub goals. So if your end goal is totally unrelated from my end goal, that's enough to get us to compete on these sub-goals. So, again, for example, suppose that, like, you and I have, like, random end goals. Well, all else being equal, if there's nothing else mitigating in this, then we're going to end up competing with each other to, like, make money or competing for some, like, pot of something.
So like, let's say, like, my end goal is, like, the thing I want out of life is to paint the White House blue, and the thing you want out of life is to make the largest stack of paper pages that you possibly can. My first move and your first move, like, we might both want to get into engineering programs in college with the plan of, like, making a bunch of money that we can then use to finance our insane goals. And so we'll compete over those slots in the top engineering colleges. Then we'll try to compete over making the money that we need to access to kind of make those things happen and so on. And so even though those two goals are completely different, and really, like, you ought to be able to say, surely you can stay out of each other's way, depending on the way the world is set up, you will find competition. So that last piece, like, depending on the way the world is set up, seems to be really important here. Like, how would we expect this to scale up into this complex world? Because, like, with the example I just cited, right, that seems like a counterargument to the idea that this should be a worry. Because if I want to paint the White House blue and you want to make a heaping stack of papers, like, I don't think would we in practice actually care about each other's goals? Like, it seems like we can kind of ignore each other. Is that not the case?
Yeah, that's the intuition, but the fact that, like, we end up competing, that's true, like, in the average case, and it's not, it may or may not be a strong effect. Like, it's still unclear, like, how strong that effect ends up being, but it definitely seems to be an effect, and it seems to be, like, a pretty consistent effect. So, you know, it might be that in that specific example, you know, you want to paint the White House blue, I want to make, like, a giant stack of papers. Maybe in that particular example, we don't end up competing, but over the set of all the possible goals that you might have, combined with the set of all the possible goals that I might have, question is, like, on average, where do we end up with? Well, on average, we end up, you know, we end up in this competitive kind of position. And so,
wow.
Yeah. And that's the case. Like, again, these are small scale things, and they're built around a particular scenario where you have these humans and the AIs. Only possible really to do the experiment under that scenario, just because for technical reasons, it turns out to be very, very hard to do, like, a general experiment. And of course, even beyond that, there's a lot of distance, right, between these kinds of experiments and the real world. This is just like, well, you know, to the extent we're able to probe and to the extent we're able to investigate, we do see this actually very clear pattern of these two don't care about each other's goals. Well, they're going to end up competing, at least to some extent, on the average case by default. And conversely, if they have exactly the same goals as one another, they will actually have identical powers at every state. So the power that I have will be the same as the power that the AI has at this, you know, state in the maze and so forth. So they exactly agree on how good the states are on average.
So that's really interesting, because that is quite a powerful claim still, you know, to the extent that what you're saying here is like, well, look, we don't know whether AIs will intrinsically be competitive with humans, will intrinsically be trying to undermine, manipulate, or control human beings. But to the extent we've been able to probe this experimentally, there is now experimental evidence in every, like, in every kind of statistical setup that we've tried, the default outcome seems to be competition.
And one of the things that means is, as one of the bottom lines for this, is that in order to get to neutral, in order to get to the point where you and I can live and let live, where you and I are not competing with each other for money or college spots or whatever, in order to get to that point requires a certain minimum degree of alignment between our goals. We maybe don't have to be super aligned, like crazy aligned, but we at least have to be, you know, we have to agree on like 20% of things on average. Something, I don't know, something like that. I really don't know what the actual number is. I'm just throwing it out there. But that seems to be one of the bottom lines here, is like, you and I need to have some kind of baseline agreement about how we want the world to look. if we want to get from default competing with each other to at least being able to stay out of each other's way. And that's in the context of this human AI scenario. So the idea here is like, well, you know, if we want a world that at least, like, at a bare minimum, you know, this AI system is not, you know, doing things that we don't like, we have to do more than zero effort to get a non-negative outcome for ourselves.
So essentially, like, if you have a you know, an AI system that's super intelligent, of the sort that, as we've seen on the podcast, like, there are a lot of people, including the very people who've built the most impressive AI systems of our era, who think that these sorts of systems could be developed in the next, like, I don't know, next decade, certainly, but some of them have timelines that are quite a lot shorter than that. If those systems exist, like, by default, we should expect, like, to be competed with, to have these systems compete with us. That seems like a recipe for some pretty significant levels of risk. Does that jive with your assessment?
Yeah, again, there's a lot of distance between these results and the real world, but to the extent we're able to do the experiment and observe the results, that certainly seems to be a reasonable conclusion. One of the questions is, one of the interesting questions, I think, that is down the road for this experimental setup is, how does the strength of this interaction change as you scale the system? So as you make the world bigger, as you add physical interactions between agents, which is one of the last experiments I did, actually, as you start to add complexity and do things in your world, how do those interactions
change? What's the trend there? Do things seem to get better or worse as things scale?
So that's a really interesting question, and the answer is slightly complicated, and it has to do with the time horizons of the different agents. Maybe we can get into it later, but it's like a sort of an extra little subtlety. My intuition is that as these systems scale and are able to optimize more and have a longer time horizon, I suspect that you start to see the threshold, the necessary threshold of alignment increase. So I suspect that it becomes more and more necessary to be, you know, more and more aligned with your system if you want the effect of that system on average on you to be neutral. So, like, if you want at least this AI not to bug you or bother you, you have to agree with it more and more and more on more and more stuff. I'm not 100% sure of that, but that's my intuition based on what, like, weak intuition based on where I'm seeing the trends.
It makes sense. And I guess the, well, the interesting thing about this line of research, I think, is that it has, and you sort of see this in the kind of AI safety world, it has shifted the burden of proof now, I think it's fair to say, onto people who claim that, oh no, AI will be fine. Like, we can have super intelligent systems that are not going to pose a risk to humans just by virtue of being created by default. It now seems like every piece of evidence that we have, like every experiment that we've done, every attempt to actually, like, create simulations of what this might look like, seem to suggest that at the very least there's reason to be worried about this. And so by default, I mean, like, to me, that's a complete shift from where this conversation was at, you know, like 5 years ago. 5 years ago, you had people throwing around hypotheticals at one end, hypotheticals at the other, and nobody really knew. It kind of seems like the early evidence, at least, is nudging us in the direction of maybe a little bit more concern, which is unfortunate. I mean, do you have any thoughts about, you know, people who might be listening to this and thinking, hey, you know, I'd love to maybe contribute to this line of research too, because it does seem very important. What would you recommend for them?
Yeah. So first off, I would agree with you. As far as I know, this is the first direct experimental evidence for the instrumental convergence thesis, and that's, like, I think that's fairly significant. But in terms of contributions, so actually, one thing I should mention, and thanks for reminding me, is I'm actually open sourcing the whole code base that I use to do these experiments, because my view now is that, okay, this is now in a position where, at the very least, you can see kind of minimal results coming out of this. Because of the way this is put together, there is actually an enormous amount of space to explore, right? In terms of, well, you know, what if we build a system that looked like this. Would that cause, like, this instrumental convergence thing?
Right.
I've only explored a very, very tiny fraction of all the different possible configurations for this stuff. The real interesting thing is, like, well, this fundamental human AI scenario, which we can play around and toy around with, and the code base itself that implements this, and the documentation around it, that enables a lot of experimentation to be done. And I am at the point where, you know, I'm not going to be able to do all these experiments myself. There's just so many different possibilities, and it just makes more sense to enable people to take it upon themselves and, like, take, you know, a weekend or a couple of weeks to just play around and see if they have any ideas or thoughts about how to, like, test something out. Because the other thing here is that there's also the potential for something like this to serve as a generator for intuitions around solutions to this problem. Because if we set up a scenario where it's like, oh, all of a sudden, you know, maybe this effect disappears or it's less strong, or we notice, like, oh, this is no longer happening as strongly as we thought. Hey, you know, maybe that's a clue. And it doesn't mean that necessarily this thing is going to work. It could just be a fluke. It could be anything. But at the very least, like, it starts the gears ticking around, well, you know, what kinds of structures or setups could we have that maybe are more robust or less amenable to this kind of competition by default? And so I think there's a rich space of areas to explore here that there's absolutely no way that I'm going to explore myself. And so that's what open source is for. And ultimately, we want this problem to be solved as fast as possible. So this seems like the best way to do that.
Yeah, and actually, you know, for people listening or people who maybe seen the Alex Turner podcast episode, you know, like, this line of research is getting a lot of attention. Like, Alex Turner's work was featured in NeurIPS, which obviously is the number one AI conference in the world. So this is, at least when you talk to people in the AI safety community, like, this kind of work is very interesting, potentially, like, at the nexus of a really big set of discoveries around AI safety or around long-term safety of AI systems. And so if you're looking for an area where you can make a really big dent, a sort of, like, low-hanging fruit thing to work on, I don't know, I've checked out a lot of this stuff and found it fascinating, found it to be one of very few paths that seem quite promising. I mean, I'm biased, obviously, and, like, we're brothers, and, you know, I've heard you talk about this a fair bit, but I've also, you know, we've spent the last 2 years on the podcast talking to folks from DeepMind, OpenAI, you know, Google AI, and so on, and this really does seem like one of those very few areas where there's real promise for progress. So I just want to pitch it out there. If people are, you know, listening to this and you're like, hey, you know, I'd love to do a little, see if I can contribute to, like, technical AI safety, maybe download the, like, fork the GitHub repo, start working on it yourself and see what you can do. I think it's, you know, a really great way to maybe make some pretty powerful and impactful research products.
And again, just like with any research, like, there's obviously a lot of assumptions that underpin it and a lot of uncertainty around it. So, you know, it's just like any other research in this field, which is, like, it's pretty tentative. It's an attempt at getting to an understanding. But yeah, I mean, I think that with the repo, with the code and the shape that it's in, at the very least, if I've done a good job of documenting it, it should be relatively low-hanging fruit even to play around with. So you can probably just, like, if you're moderately good at Python, get something interesting going in a week or so. That's at least the hope. That's how I've tried to put it together. So yeah, fingers crossed on that.
Awesome.
Well, Ed, thanks so much. I mean, I think it's so great that you did that. It's so great that you're kind of open sourcing it so anybody can play around with it. So, and thank you for sharing your thoughts again on the podcast. A lot of progress since last time you were on. So it's great to hear. And anyway, that's maybe going to wrap it up for this episode. If you want to follow Ed, you are on Twitter, on social media, at NeutronZerons. Did I get that right?
Edward Harris.
Oh, I'm sorry.
_ Edward Harris. Maybe we'll just add a link in the...
Yeah, we'll add a link in the show notes. Great. All right. Well, thanks, Ed. Thanks, everyone. That's a wrap.
Thanks for having me on.